The 60s, for many, was a time of new ideas, freedom and renewed hope, from the civil rights movements to Woodstock. But toward the end of 1969 and the start of the 70s, everything seemed to implode. The Manson murders, the events of the Rolling Stones concert Altamont, and the appearance of the Zodiac Killer all called to a halt the progress of a glorious decade. At the end of the 60s, the hippie dream died. Also, the story goes. In The Bad Trip, James Rye descends into the underworld of the 60s to reveal the dark side of the counterculture. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK, James himself. James, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Jeff. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. It was all peace and love and daisy chains and flowers in our hair and love thy neighbour, and this wasn't what happened at all.
Well, flowers in your hair and love and peace and daisy chains, etc., etc., that's very much how it was in the 60s in terms of how we remember the decade and a lot of its popular cultural appeal. But in terms of the actual 1960s, the decade itself, the historical period, things were slightly different. That narrative of it being a wonderful time, which then falls into a disaster, there are certain events like the ones you mentioned which do play into that narrative and do reiterate this idea of there being a sudden decline. But the decade as a whole was difficult. It was traumatic. It was a decade of violence, of global warfare. It was a decade marked by numerous forms of political strife and political extremism. It bookended by assassinations. So to, if you like, quarter and relegate all of this, these strange events, what Hunter S. Thompson called bad craziness, to the very end of the decade, it serves a certain purpose, but it also obscures the difficulty and the trauma, if you like, of the decade as a whole.
What was the, I mean, the thing was that the 60s was a period of massive sort of social and economic change as well, and cultural borders were being broke down that had been, you know, been running for centuries.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, because, I mean, the political and the social economic climate of the 1960s makes that possible. It is a period of great protest, exemplary protest movements. It is a period in which there's a younger, highly educated, very well-read, socially aspirant demographic comes together in a variety of ways to challenge the seemingly restrictive hierarchies of the previous generations. But we probably need to place that within the post-war context, which, if you like, gives birth to the 1960s. The world is being redrawn. Its maps are being redesigned. Certain countries are coming out of that period in a state of ruination. Other countries are coming out of that period in a state of affluence. And the 1960s, or if you like, the decade where the opportunity to define an identity, a sort of modern identity, starts to take form. And as I said, this does seem to constellate around something of a younger generation, but it is also helped and advanced and enabled by a relatively and a reasonably progressive political climate. If you think about the political climate in the UK, the first 3 years of the 1960s are connected to conservative rule, with all the ideas that you might associate with that. But from the mid-60s onwards, when you have a Labour government, there's great advances forward in terms of censorship, abortion laws are restricted, laws regarding theatre censorship are significantly relaxed, we have a partial decriminalisation of homosexuality. So there's a lot of legislation in place and there's a lot of policy-led advancements forward, and that in concert with this sort of bringing into consciousness of a youth identity makes for quite a potent mix of the old orders, the old hierarchies breaking down and in some ways being dissolved.
And also, of course, you've got the advent of the media, and in terms of television, you know, being massive throughout the 60s, where it wasn't before, you know, Marshall McLuhan talking about the global village.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, television as an actual object, as in having a television in one's home, becomes affordable. It becomes less of a luxury. There's an exponential growth, certainly in Britain and America, in terms of television ownership. And by the mid-60s, you're looking at programs going out that are getting pretty much a national audience. So we were getting enormous audiences for this particular medium, print media, in terms of both the mainstream media and also the underground media, are also taking great strides forward in terms of not just their content and their editorial policies, but also typography and design and wanting to document some of these changes. But in terms of the point that I made earlier on, it's also the work of the media that really does sort of begin to at one point make a difference, but then begin to blur together what we might refer to as the 1960s and the 60s. The idea of the 60s as this period of liberation, progress, hedonism starts to come into play very quickly. It's not really a retrospective viewpoint like the way we might look back nostalgically on the 50s. It's something that is emerging from the popular mainstream press almost by mid-decade, and certainly by the time Time magazine comes out with its portrait of London, the swinging city.
I mean, also there was this thing that you had young people who had disposable income, that they could afford to buy clothes, they could afford to buy records, they could afford to buy magazines and media.
Absolutely. I mean, the 1950s sort of gave birth to the teenager, not just in terms of a recognised social demographic, but also mainly in terms of a marketable demographic, a group of people to sell stuff to. And that continues very much into the 1960s. You have a burgeoning leisure industry, not just in terms of the availability of music and records, but you also have an explosion in terms of the paperback industry, most notably with the Penguin's decision and the legal trial concerning the paperback publication of D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover in 1960. The controversy linked to that case was not just the fact that Penguin were wanting to publish this sort of modernist classic, which was seen to be graphic and explicit in terms of its description of the body and sexual relationship. It was not just the material that they were wanting to publish in that novel. It was not just that novel itself was seen to be challenging. It was the fact that they were wanting to publish it as a mass market cheap paperback. It's fine if it is an expensive leather-bound volume, which can be read over port and cigars in the Oxbridge Club, but publishing it as a paperback, making it available in newsstands, newsagents, train stations, on the street, wherever, that's a different matter. That's letting everybody see that. So the establishment, so-called, it was almost that kind of material shift that was seen to be a challenge to those early, very strongly established institutions.
I mean, talking about the establishment, I mean, you can say, oh, it was a great time and, you know, the barriers were pushed down. Over in the States, obviously, you have the promise of JFK. You have the civil rights movement. We're celebrating this week. This week was the I Have a Dream speech as well.
Yeah.
And you know, it seemed to be that the young people through music and whatever in politics could do anything. However, the establishment was absolutely there all the way through, and they weren't going to let, you know, the counterculture push it, you know, and completely bring down the companies and the establishment, you know, the government, that sort of thing. Do you think then that the fact that the counterculture sprung up and it turned dark because, you know, they didn't have any breaks, they didn't realize that they couldn't completely change society?
Well, first of all, we probably need to see the 1960s as a decade of permission. I don't mean that in a sense of permissive,
right,
as in everyone do whatever you like, and this sort of great sort of orgiastic decade. It's a period in which there is a momentary sort of synergy between a series of protest-based demands and a certain political will to listen to those demands and to advance policy in relation to them. So it's in one sense, you could say the counterculture is enabled, it's helped, it's listened to. But then into the 1970s, one has, certainly in America, something of a rearguard action in terms of conservative thinking. Richard Nixon enters the White House in January 1969 and in a variety of ways begins to roll back some of that liberalism, some of those progressive ideologies. He gets in on a ticket which sees the seemingly radical advances as being a form of social unease and social disorder. But in addition to that narrative of, well, the counterculture springs up and then it is the challenge comes back and it sort of declines and disappears, we also probably need to think about the projects that make up what we broadly refer to the counterculture as a whole. This is a project and a cultural moment which is based on youth. It's based on a youth culture. It's based on a generation that valorizes itself as being young. That's always going to be temporary. You can't have a sort of long-standing youth culture. It's always going to age. So there is a sort of built-in temporiness to it. If you were going to be more sort of critical rather than explanatory of these things, you could say that a lot of these projects, which we could fit under the bracket of countercultural, they didn't have a kind of coherent through line. They didn't have a sort of a long game plan. Mm. I'm thinking here of certain communal projects, the idea of groups of people moving to the country to set up autonomous communities. Fabulous idea, necessary idea. A lot of them didn't last very long because ultimately they come up against this need for some kind of structure, which also seems to be ideologically disturbing for the project itself. So there is something of an ideological instability within the idea of a counterculture because it has to define itself and exist within a state of opposition. And there's a certain temporiness to that. There's always going to be a point where people get older and move on and get responsibilities, etc., etc. But also there's always going to be this internal moment of, well, to sustain this, we need to change and we need to shift and we need to recalibrate.
And that probably didn't happen. How much of an influence do you think the Vietnam War was on both sides of the Atlantic? Because this was uncensored, again, talking about permissive or, you know, the society, because for the first time, basically almost live pictures were being beamed into your front room, wherever you had your TV. And something like the 1968 storming of the US embassy, the Tet Offensive, had a massive effect, and you know, people were students in, you know, in Paris, in the States, in the Grosvenor Square in 68, you know, rose up against this.
Absolutely. Vietnam is a specter, a sort of looming cloud, which covers over the entirety of the decade, not just in terms of the social political nature of the conflict itself, not just in terms of it being a major conflict within the Cold War, in terms of its the problems and the issues linked to that sort of long-standing spectre of communism. It's a galvanizing moment. It crystallizes and it brings together lots of protest movements. It's linked to protests both domestically and also internationally. It's a kind of anchorage for lots of different protest cultures. But you're absolutely right in terms of its vividness. The reason why Vietnam gained so much resonance in terms of a clarion call for support, but also this thing to protest against, is because of that real sort of visceral intensity of its awareness within the populace. It can no longer be this thing which is taking place on the other side of the world when it is coming so graphically and so intensely into your front room. The poet Adrian Mitchell has got a great poem all about this issue itself. And he performed this at the Albert Hall in 1965 at a mass poetry reading called The Poetry Incarnation. And his poem was called To Whom It May Concern. And when he starts reading it and performing it, it sounds like a kind of childhood nursery rhyme. But he's describing terrible imagery and terrible bodily damage. And it's about the desire to look at these images, but being so horrified that he wants to turn away and turn the television off. But he's also berating his moral sense of right and his conscience for doing that. So it's a poem in which his own sense of outrage and protest gets equally sort of damaged and twisted, and he can't get himself out of this this complex of outrage and horror, and it is all based around his experience of seeing these vivid images of firebombed villages and corpses that come straight from Vietnam, and that link that moves into a play that he does with the Royal Shakespeare Company called U.S. or Us. which extends upon these themes, and that's all about the idea that to experience the full horror of this, we need to bring it home, we need to experience it directly, we need to express the intensity of this conflict to people complacently sat back here in England and America. And again, that's all about the way in which it is circulated and received in the media. So the media, if you like, is useful in terms of the ideological aspect of Vietnam, the shock and the awe and the possession of hearts and minds, but it is also a sort of lightning bolt for the protest movement and the protest culture. So again, if you were to make an extended point from that, you could see again how the counterculture is intertwined with the sort of modernizing progress of the 1960s, because it relies upon and it is entangled with the advancements in the media sphere.
And of course, for the first time, your actors, I mean, I know we had the angry young men of the 50s, but you just mentioned, you know, the theatre, but, you know, your rock stars, your pop stars weren't clean cut young men, women, and women out of the studio. Neither were your actors and actresses. The studio system was gone. People like Jane Fonda, Hanoi Jane, you had, you know, John Lennon and the Beatles getting involved in protests. You know, for the first time, there was a counterculture movement, and the media was happy to report on it because it fed the beast that is the newspaper, the press, the television.
Of course, there was if you take all those bands, if you take the Beatles and certainly the Rolling Stones, they have this very sort of antagonistic relationship throughout their career and certainly throughout the 1960s with the media, in terms of them being sort of variously sort of condemned and baited in a variety of different ways by the media, but also supported and also promoted. And them. What you see with the Beatles and certainly with John Lennon and also the Rolling Stones is throughout this period they become quite canny operators in their own use of the media, in their own ability to seize various platforms, both in terms of publicity for their own product. You know, the Rolling Stones had and continued to have a number of films made about them throughout the 1960s and beyond. They knew about the power of the image, but also in terms of the Beatles and certainly Lennon's post-Beatles career, they were very much aware that in order to capitalize upon their celebrity status, in order to translate it into effective protest, they had to work with the media and they had to work with stark, direct images. Like, for example, Lennon's record covers with Yoko Ono.
Two Virgins.
Films with Yoko Ono. Two Virgins, exactly. His films with Yoko Ono, which are based often around very, very simple, very distinct images. And, of course, the Bed In for Peace, which is them two sat there in a sort of beautiful sense of serenity. But it attracts, it's designed to attract all the media to them as individuals so they can then direct their message back outwards. So we're not really seeing these artists of the period in a sort of pseudo or semi-romantic state where they are in artistic retreats, where they're in ivory towers. They are engaged in ideas which are germane to the counterculture and also the protest movement, but they're also gaining increasing sophistication in their engagement with the media as a useful conduit.
In his book, Hunter S. Thompson, and I'm somewhat of a Hunter S. Thompson fan, and if you met me, you'd understand why, but he describes in 1967 about, in his book, Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, 71, where he's talking about the Nixon campaign, who was his nemesis. He says that, you know, if you went out at a certain point in 1967 and looked really hard, you could see the high watermark point of where the movement sort of got the highest to, just in Haight-Ashbury. It's very easy for people to say, well, the 60s began, or the death of the 60s began, the bad trip began with what happened at Altamont with the killing, the four deaths at the festival, which was a counterpoint to obviously the peace and love and the thing of Woodstock, and also the Manson murders and the Zodiac killings.
Yes, you could say that. I mean, these are very distinct sort of marker points, but on a very particular map. Hunter S. Thompson, you know, makes great play of all these references in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and also Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail. He's using, you know, Manson pops up in the prose, the process pops up in the prose, which is a reference to an apocalyptic cult called the Process Church of the Final Judgment. You know, his language is sort of peppered with these phrases and these names, which by the time time that he's publishing in the early 70s have become almost a shorthand set of symbols to talk about the 60s project going wrong. And yes, in that great visionary speech where he is talking about the high watermark, he does create this image of a beautiful moment in Hart Ashbury, a beautiful moment of possibility, which seems to very quickly evaporate afterwards. It's very easy and convenient, and in some sense it works, 2 point to Manson, 2 point to Altamont, because they seem to be events which so radically reverse what we come to expect of that project. You can look at Manson and say, well, here's a group of hippies that go out and commit murder. You can look at Altamont and say, well, here's the opposite of Woodstock, not a great gathering of the tribes, but a kind of death ritual before a set of Luciferian rock stars. The events themselves carry those ideas. Certainly the media and the documentation of those events carry those ideas and play into that narrative. But I think the point that I would make was that what we refer to as the counterculture and a lot of its philosophy, like ideas connected to the age of Aquarius, there's something of an apocalyptic undertow to those ideas themselves. One can argue that the counterculture, with its language of love, emerges and puts a lot of imperative pressure upon that language of love, because the wider world is seen to be lacking it so extremely and intensely. So the period as a whole is suffused in a variety of ways with this sense of an impending sense of doom, with a sense of global violence, with a sense that there's possibility here, but the culture as a whole, the culture at large, is moving in a very dangerous direction. People like Manson and events like Altamont come together at precisely the right time to fit a certain set of molds. They sort of fight club it in a certain way. That's to say, it's on the tip of everyone's tongue, and they just gave it a name. There's a lot of anxiety about the counterculture as a burgeoning demographic questioning the status quo, and then along comes Manson, who seems to immediately crystallize all the fears of the establishment to these long-haired hippies. Here comes Altamont, which immediately crystallized everything that everyone's been saying about the Rolling Stones for the past decade. But they sort of cap, they're sort of iceberg points for a lot of other anxieties and fissures and ideas in the counterculture as a whole. I'm not saying for one minute that the countercultural project was murderous and destructive, but I'm saying that it's concerned with those ideas. It's concerned with ideas of violence. It's not just a kind of invitation to hedonistic behavior. It's almost politicizing that, because the world in which it's born out of seems to lack all that joy and ecstasy.
You could also argue that, when the counterculture doesn't get what it wants and finds out the truth, like the Prague Spring 68, what's actually happening in Mao's China, everybody's carrying their little red books, they go violent. I'm not talking about the Black Panthers, but I'm talking about people like Baader Meinhof. And the 70s is marked by the start of massive terrorism on a global scale, reported by the media, and that surely has to be a hangover of that.
Oh yeah, it should. I mean, you can see it in these groups don't come out of nowhere. They don't come out of a vacuum. You can chart very closely a genealogy of all these groups, and their members begin in essentially nonviolent protest. If we think about the Weather Underground, also known as the Weathermen, their core group emerges out of the variety of groups who were linked to the Colombia occupation of 1968, which was meant to be this exemplary act of nonviolent protest. Within a few months, certainly by the middle part of 1969 into 1970, you've got a core that's coming out of that context who are distinctly moving towards radical armed struggle. Who are going underground as a kind of splinter cell within the American protest culture, and they later resurface bombing buildings. So yes, there is definitely very much a shift, not just to radical politics, but to terroristic strategies in the late 60s. And you can see that as one, a sort of double-pronged cause of that, in the sense of, in the face of boots in the face and armed guards, in the face of a radical right-wing consensus re-emerging, non-violent protest is not effective enough. I mean, we may condemn their methods, and rightly so, when we're dealing with anything linked to terrorism, but these shifts in the atmosphere in the protest culture, they're not just these kind of traumatic anomalies. There's a line leading to it. And for whatever reason, the people within those cultures decide that they need to change their strategy. And it does happen sort of horizontally across the protest sector at the end of the 60s.
What do you hope that people will take from the bad trip?
I hope that people will take the shock of difference from the bad trip, because we often think about, you know, where are the 60s now? What's the legacy of the 60s? Are we in a return of the 60s? I hope that people will look at that and they'll think about the way in which the counterculture worked with its surrounding political context, and the counterculture came into something of a conflict with Nixon's America, and think about what's going on now, because the way in which sort of Trump's America is working, and also one could say Johnson's UK and other leaders like Vladimir Putin, it's very difficult to work out where they actually stand and what they actually believe in. In the 60s, despite the sort of strength of certain enemies, we might say, or targets of the counterculture, it was reasonably easy to point to the points of opposition. I disagree with this person, I object to this person for the following reasons. You know, and when we think about Nixon and Watergate, we've got someone there who appears to be occupying one position, but is acting in a way that's somewhat in opposition to that. I think it's much harder to occupy that stance in the current political climate. I think we're currently moving into a period of deeply postmodern politics, which values slipperiness, which values counterintuitive strategies, which values a sort of radical superficiality.
And that's a whole new book there, James. James, the book,
redo the playbook of counterculture and protest.
I'm going to crash the news. The book is called The Bad Trip. It's out on Icon Books. It's by James Rolley. James, where can people find you on the internet?
I am at a blog called Residual Noise, and I am on the website of the English faculty at Cambridge.
It's been great to speak to you. James Rolley, author of The Bad Trip, thank you very much for your time today.
Not a problem at all. Thank you.